We're going to hear the scriptures read now, and our reading comes in two parts. So first of all, Numbers chapter 27, verses 1 to 11. And you can find that in your pew Bibles on page 167. Numbers chapter 27, verses 1 to 11. And then after that, we'll flick on a few pages to Numbers chapter 36. The daughters of Zelophehad, son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, belonged to the clans of Manasseh, son of Joseph. The names of the daughters were Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. They approached the entrance to the tent of meeting and stood before Moses, Eleazar the priest, and leaders and the whole assembly, and said, "Our father died in the desert. He was not among Korah's followers who banded together against the Lord, but he died for his own sin and left no sons. Why should our father's name disappear from his clan because he had no son? Give us property among our father's relatives." So Moses brought their case before the Lord, and the Lord said to him, "What Zelophehad's daughters are saying is right. You must certainly give them property as an inheritance among their father's relatives and give their father's inheritance over to them. Say to the Israelites, if a man dies and leaves no son, give his inheritance over to his daughter. If he has no daughter, give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, give his inheritance to his father's brothers. If his father had no brothers, give his inheritance to the nearest relative in his clan, that he may possess it. This is to be a legal requirement for the Israelites, as the Lord commanded Moses." We turn over to chapter 36, and we continue our reading there from verses 1 to the end of the chapter. The family heads of the clan of Gilead, son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, who were from the clans of the descendants of Joseph, came and spoke before Moses and the leaders, the heads of the Israelite families. They said, "When the Lord commanded my Lord to give the land as an inheritance to the Israelites by lot, he ordered you to give the inheritance of our brother Zelophehad to his daughters. Now suppose they marry men from other Israelite tribes, then their inheritance will be taken from our ancestral inheritance and added to that of the tribe they marry into. And so part of the inheritance allotted to us will be taken away. When the year of Jubilee for the Israelites comes, their inheritance will be added to that of the tribe into which they marry, and their property will be taken from the tribal inheritance of our forefathers." Then at the Lord's command, Moses gave this order to the Israelites: "What the tribe of the descendants of Joseph is saying is right. This is what the Lord commands for Zelophehad's daughters. They may marry anyone they please as long as they marry within the tribal clan of their father. No inheritance in Israel is to pass from tribe to tribe, for every Israelite shall keep the tribal land inherited from his forefathers. Every daughter who inherits land in any Israelite tribe must marry someone in her father's tribal clan, so that every Israelite will possess the inheritance of his fathers. No inheritance may pass from tribe to tribe, for each Israelite tribe is to keep the land it inherits." So Zelophehad's daughters did as the Lord commanded Moses. Zelophehad's daughters, Mahlah, Tirzah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Noah, married their cousins on their father's side. They married within the clans of the descendants of Manasseh, son of Joseph, and their inheritance remained in their father's clan and tribe. These are the commands and regulations the Lord gave through Moses to the Israelites on the plains of Moab, by the Jordan, across from Jericho. Amen. And we thank God for his word.
Well, let's turn to those readings that we had earlier, to Numbers 27 and then also Numbers 36. I was not able to get to our last table quiz in church, which is a shame because I always enjoy them. At least I enjoy most parts of them. I'll tell you a bit that makes me a little bit uneasy. It's the Bible round. Because there I am sitting at the table and the quizmaster says, "Now it's time for the Bible round." And everybody turns around and looks at me and says, "Oh, we're okay now. We'll play our joker." And my heart sinks because some of the questions that can pop up in the Bible round will fox anybody, and I don't claim to have better Bible knowledge than anybody else. For example, when I read down through the stories of the biggest story Bible that we are following as we go through this curriculum in our mornings, and I saw this one, the daughters of Zelophehad, I have to confess, I thought, what on earth is that about? And who are the daughters of Zelophehad? Now, the second question is easier to answer, of course. The Bible lists them for us. I listened
to Stephen really, really carefully.
Mala, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. Noah obviously could be a boy's name and a girl's name at that time. So you get those into your head for the next church table quiz. I'm sure that'll come up. But as to what the story is about, well, that's going to take us a little bit more time. And that's what we're thinking about this morning. It turns out that the daughters of Zelophehad are mentioned 5 times in the Bible. 4 of those times, they're all named, they're all listed. And therefore, they're pretty important. And they're certainly pretty important in Numbers, because this is where we are introduced to them. Now, I've got to say, I wasn't able to find out all that much on these chapters, to be honest. But I did come across a really, really helpful Kevin DeYoung sermon, and I'm leaning heavily on that today and some of the insights that he has that have been really, really good. And I would really recommend that to you if you Google it. There are not many sermons on the daughters of Zelophehad, so if you put in Kevin DeYoung and even Zelophehad, you'll probably find it. So what's going on in Numbers? Well, we know that Numbers largely recounts the stories of the children of Israel in the wilderness, and particularly recounts their grumblings and their rebellions. And that explains, it is Numbers that explains why they are in the desert for 40 years. They had the opportunity to enter the promised land. They sent the spies in to spy out the land, 12 of them. 10 of them brought back the bad report to say, yes, the land is flowing with milk and honey, but there are giants there and we cannot do this. And 2 of them, Caleb and Joshua, they see the same things. When they bring back a good report, a report that is full of faith, and they say, yes, there are challenges here, but God has given us this land, and we can surely do it. But the people, of course, go with the bad report. They grumble, and God says that they will perish in the desert. At the time, they say, we wish we had perished in the desert, and God basically says, okay, you're going to get what you want. And the entry to the promised land is delayed until that whole generation perishes in the desert. Now, Numbers 26, the chapter before this one, marks the beginning of the new generation, the new story. The first part of the book begins with a census of the generation that rebels against the Lord and dies in the desert. And then Numbers 26 is another census, and it's the census of the new generation. And so here are the people, you see, of the new generation who will enter the promised land. And at the beginning of that story, we are introduced to the daughters of Zelophehad. And then at the end of Numbers 36, we're told about the daughters of Zelophehad again. So the daughters of Zelophehad, they bookend this section of Numbers that is dealing with those who are going to enter the promised land. And you can see, therefore, that they are important in the story. So what do they do? Well, Numbers 27, they come to Moses with a request. They do so publicly at the entrance to the tent of meeting. It's before the assembly. And you can see what they say in verse 3. Our father died in the wilderness. He was not among Korah's followers who banded together against the Lord, but he died for his own sin and left no sons. Why should our father's name disappear from his clan because he had no son? Give us property among our father's relatives. Okay, let's try and unpack this a little bit. Their father Zelophehad is dead. He was not one of those who rebelled with Korah, the wicked, rebellious followers of Korah. It says he died for his own sins. Now, what that means is he was just like everybody else from that generation. God had pronounced that judgment on that generation, and he was just like everyone else, not particularly worse or better than anyone, just one of those people. And now he had indeed died. But he had had only girls. You can just imagine. 1 girl, 2 girls, 3 girls, 4 girls. And then the midwife comes out to him and says, what do you think it is? It's a girl. 5 girls. Now, girls are good. Don't hear me wrong. But in those days, the right to inherit the land usually went with the boys. And what would happen, therefore, to the land of Zelophehad? Now, maybe this doesn't seem like a huge deal to us. Oh, we read these, sort of come across these passages about land and inheritance and so on. We don't think all that much of them. But you imagine yourself living on a huge farm somewhere. It's been in your family for generations and generations, and then the head of the family passes away, and there's a reading of the will. You imagine the whole family gathering. And to your horror, you hear that this land that has been in your family for generations has been left to a donkey sanctuary or something. And you begin to then feel this land is really, really important. And Kevin DeYoung actually points out that while we tend to sort of skim read over those passages about allotments of land and inheritance and so on, those who were getting it would have read it really, really closely. They would have said, where does that boundary go? It goes up along that river and it goes that way and it goes that way. They would have been hugely interested in that. And not only that, of course, it is the land that God is giving them. This is the most important thing. It is the promised land. It's what God has for them. It's part of the blessing of being his people in his place with his presence. And for a family, you see, to fully enjoy the blessing of God's, they're expecting to have some of the land. And so chapter 27 deals with the problem of not having any sons. Who will inherit the land? And Moses takes this to God, and beautifully it says in verse 6, the Lord said to him, what Zelophehad's daughters are saying is right. You must certainly give them property as an inheritance among their father's relatives and give their father's inheritance to them so that the land would continue in the family, but also so that the family name would not disappear from amongst the clan. Now, chapter 36, we're not going to take just as much time on that, but chapter 36, there's a slightly different issue. What happens whenever the daughters marry? Because normally, their goods would then transfer into that clan. And so you would have an area that was inhabited by the tribe of Manasseh, for example, and then there would be maybe a parcel of land that was owned by the tribe of Dan. It would all get very confusing, and eventually the whole thing would sort of fall apart. And so God speaks again on the issue, chapter 36, verse 5, what the tribe of the descendants of Joseph is saying is right. This is what the Lord commands for Zelophehad's daughters. They may marry anyone they please as long as they marry within their father's tribal clan. No inheritance in Israel is to pass from one tribe to another, for every Israelite shall keep the tribal inheritance of their ancestors. They marry within the clan, they keep the land within the clan, and that way the land and the family name carries on. So that's what happens, but what are we to learn from this? Well, there are all sorts of ways of misapplying this. I've come across people who introduced the sermon by saying, have you ever been afraid to claim what's rightfully yours? And a whole congregation goes out and is all sort of fired up to go and claim what's rightfully theirs. What a disaster that would be. Others see this as an example of early feminism. Here are oppressed women making a stand for women's rights in a male-dominated society, and they manage to persuade God it's a good idea. Some really outrageous things said along those lines. Neither of those, I think, are examples of how we apply this passage. What's happening here is that these strong women are being held up for us as examples of faith. I wonder, has it registered with you yet that they are talking about land that they have not yet received? The land is in the promised land, and they are in the wilderness. The promised land is still ahead of them. It's been promised but not obtained. A couple of weeks ago, we looked at the crucial incident where the spies return. 10 of them say, the land's flowing with milk and honey, but there are giants. We can't do this. And 2 of them say it's a great land, but God has promised and we can surely do it. What a difference for the 2 spies compared to the 10 spies. What was the difference? They had faith. We can surely do it. And you see Numbers, as it is ending, is saying, this is the generation that's going to inherit the promised land. They're going to possess the promised land. What is going to be required for them to do it? Faith. Where can we find an example of faith? We can find an example of faith in the daughters of Zelophehad. Now, whenever we talk about faith, we need to think maybe just a little bit more carefully about it, because it's a word that is used in all sorts of ways today within our society, and sometimes we fall into thinking about faith like the world and not like the scriptures. Because sometimes the way people talk about faith is that they're just talking about that general sense of optimism that they try to work up in themselves, and it's really not based on anything other than optimism. Sometimes it means little more than just having a positive attitude, and maybe without any real reason. You know, somebody's football team has lost all of their games that season and they're heading for relegation, and someone says, but you just have to hold on, you just have to have faith. One dictionary definition I found said, faith is a firm belief in something for which there is no proof. Now that's the way that people think about faith often, but that's not the Bible's idea of faith. The biblical idea is to trust in God because of evidence, because of past experience, because of what God says. It is trusting in something because God has said it often, or because God has promised it. That sort of optimistic, everything will turn out okay idea doesn't stand up to scrutiny, because ultimately it's got to matter what our faith is in. We've used a number of illustrations before for this. The one that maybe we could use is that of trusting a parachute. I've never done a parachute jump. Some of you have, I know. But if I was doing that solo jump and the instructor said, now, you know, go and get your parachute, and I mistakenly put on a North Face rucksack with his lunch in it, and I got up into the plane and he never noticed, and then 3, 2, 1, green light, go, out I go, and I could enjoy the experience. I probably wouldn't actually, but I could enjoy the experience of falling through the air and seeing everything and all the rest of it, and I could have absolute faith in my North Face rucksack and in his sandwiches. But when I went to pull the thing that wasn't there, then I would find that my faith was in the wrong thing. It matters what the object of your faith is. That's what's really, really key. Is what we have put our faith in reliable? That's what really makes the difference at the end of the day. And in the Bible, we're called to put our faith in God and in what he says. And there's nothing more reliable than that. And those two good spies, you see, Joshua and Caleb, were not saying, ah, you know, promised land, I'm sure it'll be okay. They were saying, God has promised us this land. He has said it, and he does not lie, and he does not change, and we can therefore surely do this. It was faith based on the evidence. He will give it to us. Their faith was in what God said. And this is what we see here. That first generation had listened to the bad report. They did not trust what God said. But now here come these daughters of Zelophehad, and they trust what God has said. They have faith in the Lord. And so two lessons this morning for us, two points really from this part of the Bible. The first one is this. We need to trust God for what we have not yet received. We need to trust God for what we've not yet received. This is what the girls do. We've made that point. They are thinking into the future, and they're saying, God has promised that we'll receive that land, and we surely will. I know that he will come through in his promise. And they're looking years ahead. They're looking far beyond the day that they go into the promised land, because they want the land to go to their family after that, and their family after that. They're thinking long into the future. They're trusting God for a long, long way ahead. Now, when you think about it, there is so much about living as a follower of Jesus that means trusting him for what you've not yet received. Maybe we have a challenging week ahead, a challenging day perhaps that lies in front of us. And in the morning of that day, we call to our minds that God has said, 2 Corinthians 12, my grace is sufficient for you, my power is made perfect in weakness. And you're thinking, well, the Lord said that to Paul, and he says that to me, and I'm going to trust that as I go into this week or as I go into this situation today, that his grace will be sufficient for me, that he will give me what I need. Now, I'm not there yet. I'm not in that challenging situation yet, but I'm trusting him now for what I've not yet received. We say the Lord's Prayer. We say, give us this day our daily bread. And perhaps we do not know how God is going to provide for us, but we're asking and we're trusting for what we've not yet received. Maybe we lose a believing loved one, as many in our congregation have, and we trust that God will keep them. We trust that we will see them again. We have not entered into that reality yet. But we can trust him because the Lord has promised that not one that the Father has given to him will be lost. We haven't seen them again, but we are believing the Lord for what we've not yet received. We think about our future. We get anxious about what it will be like to leave this scene of time and stand before the Lord. We're conscious of our many sins. We feel we've made such a mess of our Christian lives at times. We've messed up so badly, and our hearts are so divided sometimes, and we make a poor job of following Jesus. And we wonder, what will it be like to stand before the Lord as we are? How can we face that day with confidence? And then we recall that God has said in his word, there is now therefore no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. We're not standing before the Lord yet, but we know that we can believe that he will receive us because he has spoken over us this word of no condemnation. We're trusting God for what we have not yet received. So do you see then these girls? They bookend this new generation that will enter the land, and they're held up to the Israelites and say, look at these girls. They're trusting what God has said. Look at what they're doing. They're looking ahead. They're talking about the things that they have not yet received, but they know that they will because God is faithful. I remember Rico Tice said that 99% of the blessings that God has to give us are not in this life. We're always trusting God for what we've not yet received. That's the first thing. The second thing is we need to live now in the light of what God will do. We need to live now in the light of what we believe God will do. That's what these girls do, isn't it? They believe what God has said will happen, and they don't just sit back and think, well, that's nice. Doesn't mean we don't need to do anything about that. No, they take action. And they take action in the light of what God has said. They take decisions and they make requests and they take a stand now in the light of what lies ahead of them. It was a big thing to do what they did. Chapter 27, verse 2, they came forward and stood before Moses, Eleazar, the priest, the leaders, and the whole assembly at the entrance to the tent of meeting. So they didn't just send a quiet email, would you please consider this? They stand in front of Moses. Perhaps there are all sorts of hoops that they have to jump through, legal hoops and administrative hoops to get to present their case to Moses. Moses is the one who adjudicates on the tricky things, and it makes its way up through the system. And there they are. They're there in front of the whole assembly. This daunting thing, but they do it because they believe that God's promises lie ahead, and they are therefore emboldened to do what they did. They knew that God had promised them a land and a blessing that they would share in. And yet, isn't it the case that here we are today and we have so much more than they did? 1 Peter says this, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy, he has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Christ from the dead and into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade. This inheritance is kept in heaven for you, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time." If you're here today, you're a Christian. If you're listening today and you're a Christian, you have an inheritance kept in heaven for you. Kept in heaven for you. There is so much blessing that awaits the children of the Lord. Now, what sort of people would we be if we lived in the light of what God will do, what God has for us? Wouldn't we be more courageous? Wouldn't we be more full of joy? Wouldn't we be quicker to share our faith, to stand up for what is right, to give of ourselves because we know that this world is not our home and we have a heavenly inheritance? Let me give you, as we close, an example from church history that I love. It's from John Chrysostom. He was Archbishop of Constantinople, Istanbul, 397 AD. His name means golden mouth. He was well known for his preaching. And sometime in the early 5th century, about 404, we think, the Empress Eudoxia removed him for his position and threatened to banish him if he continued as a Christian preacher. And he stood before the Empress. She held his life in his hands, really. And apparently the following conversation took place. "You cannot banish me," said John, "for this world is my Father's house." The Emperor said, "But then I will kill you." He said, "But you cannot, for my life is hid with Christ in God." "I will take away your treasure," Eudoxia said. "No, you cannot, for my treasure is in heaven and my heart is there. But I will drive you away from your friends and you will have no one left," Eudoxia responded. "No, you cannot," said John, "for I have a friend in heaven from whom you cannot separate me. I defy you, for there is nothing you can do to harm me." We need to live in the light of what God will do and what he has for us. What do we need to trust God for today? Something that's coming at us, something that is pressing us down. What do we need to trust him for today? We need to live in the light of what God will do. How could we live as those who trust what God promises? Put your faith in him, church. He will not let you go.